guess we will get started. Maybe some more people will come in later. Today we have a special guest, a guest listener this time, Sokrates Katsikas, who will actually next week be in the role of guest lecturer. He will then say something about the critical infrastructure security, which is an introduction more or less to the course he's giving in the third semester in the technology track. Let me go to where I should go. Okay, so today I will say something about first intrusion detection, chapter 8, and then the next hour I will say something about firewalls and intrusion prevention, which is chapter 9. So this is where we are. The content of the book I'll follow, and I'll start with the kind of intruders we can expect when we're talking about intrusion detection. First group is what we refer to as cyber criminals. So it's an individual or a group of individuals which have a goal which is financial reward. So the goal that they have when they are trying to intrude your system is gaining some financial reward from that. They have a number of ways to do that. They can steal your identity, try to get a loan in your name, buy stuff in your name. They try maybe directly to steal your financial credentials like credit card number and CVC code, etc. They can do data ransoming. So they get access to your system, they encrypt the files, and you only get them back when you pay some ransom for that. So they are trying to have financial gain. Typically, they're young, often from Eastern Europe, Russia, East Asia, so these kinds of areas. They meet, they have these underground fora where they can meet and where they can exchange IDs and everything. So that's one group of potential intruders. Another one is activists or hacktivists. Again, an individual or a group, but they don't want financial gain. They want a motivation by a social or maybe a political cause. I guess we all know, I forgot the names now, the activist groups. Anonymous, yes, exactly. That's the one I was looking for. So that falls really within this category. Maybe people like Snowden would also fall in this group. Skill level, often relatively low. And as said, the aim is not financial gain. The aim is to present to the public their wider cause. So that's what they want to do. They often use denial of service attacks, but they can do different things also. Theft and distribution of data, that's what we saw in the Snowden case, for example. And then the third group of players, state-sponsored organizations. So these are large groups where there is a lot of knowledge within the group and where they are sponsored or maybe organized actually by the government. We talked last week about advanced persistence threats. These are the groups that that take care of these advanced persistence threats. We think mostly about NSA, or no, let's say USA, I should say. Maybe Russia, China, but also if we believe what Snowden has all published, the UK was spying on Belgium, the Germans were spying on the Americans, etc., etc. So everybody is spying on everybody. So, but no means just these groups that are mentioned here. And then beside these three more or less well-defined groups, there is a number of other individuals that fall outside these groups. That could be people just wanting to show their knowledge or something like that. Yeah, there's no financial gain, there's no political motive or whatever. They just do it for the fun of it. These are the people that have a certain level of knowledge that might be not present in cyber criminals or in hacktivists. These people can come up with new kinds of attacks in very innovative ways. We can call them hobby hackers if you want. So that's if we look at the motivation, we can divide the hackers or the intruders in different groups. If we look at what they can do, their skill level, we can also define three levels. The lowest level is apprentice. So these are hackers with really little technical knowledge. They use tools that are available. They buy these tools online. They just use the tools. They don't do any adaption to that. They just use what they can buy and try to make money or try to reach their political goals with that. Mostly cyber criminals and the activists or hacktivists are found in this group. A little more skill level is the journeyman. They also mainly access these given tools, but they are able to understand better what is going on and to make adjustment to the tools if needed. So they have a bit more knowledge of what's going on, and they will use that knowledge to improve the toolkit that they have. Can be found in all groups. That could be cyber criminals, that could be hacktivists, that could be the hobby hackers, and they can be found in the government-sponsored organizations. And then the highest level is, of course, the master level, where we mainly find the people that work for the state-sponsored organizations, state-sponsored intruders. These are the group that really come up with the new attacks, the zero-day vulnerabilities, etc. These are the groups that actually build these toolkits that are used by others. So, obviously, defending against the first two levels is much easier than defending against this level of skill. If we think about intrusion, there are many different kinds of intrusions. What is interesting, if you look at the bottom line, using an unattended workstation, if I would go away, somebody using this machine is also considered as an intruder. Yeah, but there are different types of intrusion that you can distinguish. Okay. Let's see where we are. There. Let's see what an intruder needs to do. First of all, an intruder needs to find a target, and he needs to get some information about this target. What kind of system is he using? Is he using Unix, Linux, Windows, whatever? Yeah, he needs to get some information on this person. Then there is the initial access. So he has to get into the system. He has to find a weakness, a vulnerability to exploit to get into the system. And once there, often at a normal user level, he has to see if he can upgrade his privileges to maybe administrator root level. Yeah, so he has to try to get an escalation of the privileges. Once he has that, he can start gathering the information he wants. He can start exploiting the system. Yeah, once he is in. But while doing that, he also has to make sure that he maintains access. So often this is not just as a one-time access to a system. They want to stay into a system and use it as much as possible. And that also includes covering the tracks and making sure that whatever the victim can see is not showing that the intruder is there, or as little as possible. Hardly readable, I guess, but there's a list of things that they can do for each of these cases. Okay, so that's more or less as a small introduction. So we have intruders, and they want into our systems, and so what we want to do is obviously detect that something is going on. First, let's start with two definitions. First, the definition of a security intrusion, a security event or combination of multiple security events that constitutes a security incident in which an intruder gains or attempts to gain access to a system without having authorization to do that. So a security intrusion is the attempt to get into a system. successful or not successful, the attempt to get into a system. And intrusion detection is a security service that monitors and analyzes system events for the purpose of finding and providing real-time or near-real-time warning of attempts to access system resources in an unauthorized manner. So intrusion detection is actually the countermeasure, making sure that you notice that somebody is doing something. And not in 2 days' time, I get a message that, hey, somebody was in there. No, I want it now or very soon, such that I can take action. If I look at an intrusion detection system, actually there are three components. There's sensors, and they collect information on what's going on. And then they do some kind of analysis on this data to see what could be security related, what could be related to an intrusion. And then they send that information to an analyzer who will have a closer look at that. And once it's detected that indeed something is going on, an intrusion is going on, they will send it to a user interface where an administrator gets a message that, hey, there is an intrusion going on here, and he or she can then take action. So it's really just detection of the intrusions. No action is taken, except notifying. We'll talk about intrusion prevention in the second half of today, and then a system can take action. But in this case, it's just notifying somebody. Yeah, maybe putting something in a log file or whatever, but somebody is notified in some way through a user interface. There are three types of intrusion detection system. One is host-based, so it's located on host itself. I can monitor the complete network and look at the network traffic or whatever to see if there are intrusions going on, so network-based intrusion detection systems. And then we have a hybrid or distributed, a form in between, so to say. How can we detect intrusions? Well, intrusions are generally detected because what is happening is out of the normal. If all the behavior on this machine is as it should be, then there is no reason to believe that something is going on. Yeah, but if I can detect something that is out of the ordinary, yeah, that could indicate an intrusion. But unfortunately, if we analyze the behavior of a regular user, the authorized user, and the behavior of an intrusion, there is overlap between that. Things that I would normally do on this machine can also be part of an intrusion, and the other way around. Yeah, what is normally seen as part of an intrusion, that could be something that I also do. Maybe not a lot, but occasionally. Yeah, so there is not a real clear division between authorized usage and intrusion. And so, yeah, there will be made errors when we try to detect intrusions. Some intrusions will not be detected, false negative, and some regular usage will be detected as intrusion, which is called a false positive. There is something in intrusion detection system which is called base rate fallacy. And that has to do with the fact that there is a lot of genuine usage of a system and just few intrusion attempts. Here is an example. Suppose that we monitor traffic. And we monitor packets on a system, so network intrusion detection system. And just 0.01% of all the traffic that we see is in fact related to intrusions. All the rest is genuine. So this system is in a network, and the network is not under attack most of the time, but sometimes there are small attacks. And we have an intrusion detection system which works pretty good. All of the intrusion packets, 99% will be identified as being an intrusion. Will be filtered out, could be filtered out, or will be sent to the administrator, to the interface. And only 1% of the authorized traffic will be falsely flagged as being an intrusion. That's pretty good, right? Let's, for the moment, assume we have 1 million packets over some time. Don't know if that's an hour or a day or whatever, but 1 million packets. 0.01% of that is intrusion related, which is just merely 100 packets. And all the other 999,900 are benign. Now, if we look at these 100 intrusion packets, the intrusion detection system will detect 99% of those. So that will be, in fact, 99 packets. So only one packet out of these million will go into the system, which is, in fact, an undetected packet that is related to intrusion, which is pretty good, right? But then look at what happens with all the alarms that are raised. In 99 cases, an alarm will be raised, those intrusion packets that are detected by the system. But there will also be, in 1% of all the benign packets, there will be an alarm raised, which is 9,999. So in fact, the administrator, which is sitting behind his graphical user interface, he will get slightly over 10,000 alarms, of which 99 are real alarms, and all the other ones are false alarms. And so less than 1% of what he sees is a real alarm. So what happens? A new alarm pops up. He will quickly look at it and says, oh no, that's benign. Click. Okay. The next one, okay. Okay. At some point he will get so lazy he will hardly look at what the actual alarm is. We train the administrator to just push the okay button instead of really learning paying attention to what's going on. Yeah, so purely because of the low amount of intrusion traffic, we still have a poor performance of the system. There's some requirements that we have to have on a intrusion detection system. One of them is obviously it will run continuously. It should be resistant against attacks on itself. Yeah, so it should not be possible to just stop it from the outside or whatever. If we need to change the configuration, that should be done automatically. We should not have to stop the IDS and then restart it afterwards. So there's a number of requirements that have to be fulfilled for a good IDS. But you can read about that in the book yourself. Let's see how we can do the analysis. Yeah, we get information and somehow we have to determine intrusion or not, or benign. There are two main approaches. One is anomaly detection, and one is signature or heuristic detection. The anomaly detection is more or less what we had in the graph before. We know what normal behavior is, what normal network traffic is, or whatever. If we look at host or network IDS, we know what normal behavior is. We have the current behavior, and we have to see does the current behavior is that normal or can it be classified as intrusion? Yeah. Obviously, there is a difficulty in how to model the behavior on a system or on a network. In case of signature or heuristic detection, we know a set of malicious data patterns or attack rules that can be seen on a network, that have been seen in the past. And based on that, we know that if we see such a packet again, or such a data pattern again, we know that this is an attack also. Yeah, so we can just check for what we know is an attack, is an intrusion. Obviously, then we can protect against new kinds of intrusions. Yeah, so the downside here is that if there is a new kind of attack, new kind of intrusion, there needs to be an addition to this set of signatures. Yeah, such that it can be recognized later on. Compare it to virus scanning. Yeah, if we have a known virus, we can detect that. If there is a new virus, it's a zero-day vulnerability. Yeah, system can't detect it because there's no signature for it yet. Yeah, so both approaches have obviously advantages and disadvantages. If we look at anomaly detection, there are a number of ways we can do that particular detection once we have a model of the normal situation. Yeah, we can do either statistical analysis, or we can look at knowledge base or machine learning pattern recognition techniques. So there are different ways of doing the detection there. That's not so important at this point in time. In case of signature or heuristic, in case of signature first, we have a large set of known attack patterns, known malicious data patterns. And we just check if the data we're seeing, if that matches one of those patterns in an efficient way. And if so, we just mark it as intrusion. If not, we'll just let it pass. Now, the signature size, the signature database obviously needs to grow over time once new attacks get known. Rule-based, yeah, more or less works the same. Snort, which is also a part of this chapter, is in fact an example of this rule-based network intrusion detection system. So I mentioned network and host-based intrusion detection system before. I will now go into these two, and also quite quickly into distributed. First, host-based intrusion detection system. We can use anomaly or signature-based, heuristic-based. That doesn't matter. Both of them will work. When I do the intrusion detection at a host within a network, I can not only protect against attacks from the outside going into the network, I can also protect inside the network itself from my neighbor trying to attack me over the network, because the detection is done on the end system. What kind of information can I use? Specifically, for example, if I use anomaly detection, I can look, for example, at system call traces. I can look at the log file. Is there anything strange in the log file? I can look at file integrity checksums. So if there is an intrusion that is starting to change files, for example, by adding a virus to it, the file changes, and hence the checksum of that file changes. I can look at if there is access to the registry, or if configuration files are being changed. If I look at a Unix system, then I have a lot of system calls. So I can have a quite close look at what's going on. For the Windows system, yeah, they're using DLLs. It's less granularity, but still, there is a possibility to use that too. Not obviously as good as in the Linux system. Yeah, so these things I can do on a system itself, looking at a single system. If I look at the network, I can measure the network traffic at specific points in my network, in my area network. What it does, what a network-based intrusion detection system does, is look at packets in real time or near real time, and then based on that make a decision. Can look at different level of protocols, network protocol, transport protocol, maybe even application level protocol. Yeah, looks at the, it analyzes each packet and then makes a decision based on that. I can place multiple network intrusion detection systems within a network. Doesn't need to be on one location. I can spread them out and collect the information from all of these sensors. Analysis can be done by either the sensor, or when it forwards the information, can be done by the management server also, or maybe a combination of the two. What kinds of sensors do we have? We have the inline sensor, which means that the traffic will pass through the sensor. The analysis is done inside the inline sensor, and then it's forwarded. So this could be a slight delay in the traffic. And then we have a passive sensor, which just takes a copy of all the network. So if you look there, the network just passes unhindered, but there is a copy from the outgoing and the ingoing traffic anyway. and that is sent to the sensor. So for the users in such a network, they notice nothing of this. Yeah, in case of the inline sensor, they might see a small delay. Certainly, if there is a high traffic load, then the inline sensor has to work very hard. And there might be a small delay in delivery of packets. In case of a passive sensor, just a copy is taken and the traffic flows as it normally does. Yeah, so the users don't notice that. Yeah, just said that. Where should we put the sensor? Network-based intrusion detection sensor. We'll talk about firewalls later on, so then you will hear the term external firewall a bit more. We can place it just inside the external firewall. The external firewall is actually the firewall between my own network, my own company network, and the big outside world, so the rest of the internet. That's called the external firewall. Yeah, if I just place it behind, so in my own network, just behind the firewall, yeah, I can see all the traffic that comes from the outer wall, except the one that is filtered out by the firewall, of course. But if there is a problem with the firewall, at least I can notice this. Yeah, if I see traffic coming in that actually is a form of intrusion, form of attack, and the firewall did not filter that out, then we can adjust the firewall settings based on this. If for some reason the firewall misses an attack, and the network intrusion detection system misses the attack, yeah, it could be that still the attack is detected because the intrusion could just try to send out a lot of information to the attacker. Yeah, and that kind of traffic is, again, out of the ordinary, so that could be detected by this particular network-based IDS sensor in this location. We could place actually the network intrusion detection system on the other side of the firewall, so on the outside of the external firewall. So between the internet and the firewall, which means that it sees all the traffic, all the kinds of attacks, and you have a better idea of how much your organization is under attack. Now obviously, this NIT sensor needs to work much harder than the first one. We can also place the intrusion detection sensors before our valuable information, which could be the servers that we have, the databases that we have running. Yeah, we'll place the intrusion detection system there, which then also would be able to detect an attack from an internal source. So I don't have access to some information, but still I try to reach that server or that database, and that could also be detected. That can't be detected by any of the other two intrusion detection systems. Similar, we can, if we have a separation, if we split up our local area network in certain segments, we can have intrusion detection system also before each of such segments, and we can also see if there is indeed internal intrusion, internal attackers. In the picture, it looks like this. So we have the first there, just right after the external firewall, which is monitoring probably the traffic into the normal network and into the demilitarized zone here at the bottom, which I will again discuss in the next presentation. We have the one on the outside of the external firewall, so monitoring everything, and then we have the ones inside the network, so the more granularity. There were two potential techniques for doing intrusion detection. One was signature or heuristic based, the other one was anomaly based. So depending on what kind of attack there is, one or the other method gives me better results. For example, anomaly detection is better for denial of service attacks. because we can detect that, hey, there is a huge amount of traffic going on, which is out of the ordinary, so that can qualify as an attack there. Other attacks like unexpected application service or some attacks at application or transport layer, they can easily be more easily be detected by signature-based intrusion detection system. Then every time that an intrusion is detected, true or false, positive, that doesn't matter, there needs to be a record of that. Yeah, so the analyzer sends something to the user interface. Yeah, there needs to be sufficient information such that the administrator can make a good choice on is this a real attack or not. So, for example, we have the time when it happens. We have the source input and output. Source and destination IP address. We have port numbers that are used, etc., etc. So all that information needs to be logged once a potential intrusion is detected. Then, I won't say much about this, but if we have a hybrid system, we use a combination of host intrusion detection, network intrusion detection. Yeah, you get obviously a better performance, but there is also a cost of having more policies, etc., etc. We'll not go into that. I will go more into very briefly into the intrusion detection exchange formats, because we have different kinds of systems and they might need to work together, specifically in the distributed system. There has been an internet engineering task force that has come up with 3 requests for comments regarding this. There was one on the requirements for an exchange format. There was one on the intrusion detection message exchange format itself, and one on a protocol for distributing this kind of information. And the idea here is that if we have different kinds of sensors, and they get data on activity, we have different kinds of sensors, and they have to all talk to an analyzer that looks at events that could be of interest. That needs to be in a common format and a common way of communication between all of these building blocks to make sure that all the information is in fact used in a good manner. I would like to finish this first presentation off with honeypots, because that's a new concept. A honeypot is information that is there to attract intruders. No, maybe that's the wrong way of saying it. It's not there to attract intruders. It's there to, once there is an intruder, to attract him to that part of the network. So once there is an intruder on my system, I don't want him to reach the valuable information. I want to attract him to the honeypot. That's heady. So we want to have him, the attacker, the intruder, away from the critical systems, obviously. Why do I want to do that? Well, first of all, I do want him not reaching the critical information, that's clear. But also I want to have an intruder for a bit of longer time in my system. If I would detect an intrusion and I would right away kick him out, he could come back without me noticing it the next time. If I let him play around in the honeypot for a while, I can learn what his capabilities are, how he works. I can learn something from the attacker that can help me in the future, attacking against either the same intruder or different ones. Encourage the attacker to stay on the system long enough for the administrators to respond. Respond doesn't mean right away kicking out. Yeah, I notice that. Respond could be just to learn of what they are doing. I've heard about attackers that actually left log files in a system. So these were bigger organizations doing this. They left log files in a system where they, for other members of the group, where they could see what the other person had been doing and just using that and continuing the attack. Yeah? Well, we learned something. First of all, there is a larger group. Probably they're quite smart. The honeypot obviously should contain some information. If it's an empty disk, yeah. As an intruder, I have quickly seen that there is nothing there and I leave. So there should be some information there, and the information should look real. Shouldn't be real. It should look real enough for me to start browsing a bit more there. Obviously, it should not have a production value, because then I'm losing information. But it should be interesting at the very least. It should look interesting. There are two kinds of honeypots, a low interaction honeypot and a high interaction honeypot. The first one is more a system that has some functionality, but not all functionality. So it doesn't really mimic a real life system sufficiently enough to keep an intruder in there for a bit. But if he would stay in there too long, he would detect that he is in fact not browsing around a real system, but a fabricated system, and he would know that he is in a honeypot. The high interaction system is a full system, full operating system. Everything works as it should be. Obviously, that will trick the intruder longer. Yeah, but it will also mean from the company's perspective that more time needs to be spent on maintaining such a system. Yeah, otherwise, it doesn't work anymore. Also, in that particular case, care should be taken that the intruder cannot use the honeypot system actually as a leaping board into the rest of the system. So you should contain the intruder really into the fake system. Where to put the honeypot? Well, this is a normal representation of a network. So we have the external firewall. Behind that, we have a demilitarized zone with some servers that need to be accessed from the outside, like a web server, for example. We can place a honeypot there with a web page that looks like the real one, something like that, or maybe database or whatever. And the rest of the network, we can place honeypots there also. Or maybe we can put it completely outside the firewall. And there are different places where we can put it. The last part that I don't present here is actually on Snort. Go over that part of the book yourself and see how indeed the Snort rules that how they work. You can do that yourself. Okay, that was the first part for today. Any questions? I did not mention HoneyNet, no. I must say that the concept of HoneyNet is new to me, but I guess a HoneyNet is the same as a honeypot, except it doesn't represent a system, but it represents a network. Yeah. In general, if you have a honeypot or a honeynet, access to that by default is illegitimate, because there is no reason for me as a normal user to get to that part of my network, because there is no real information there. So any access to a honeypot or a honeynet is flagged as suspicious. Yeah, other than maybe the administrator trying to set up the honeypot or maintain the honeypot or whatever. Yeah, but any other access is flagged as suspicious. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? If not, then let's start again at 12:15, and then we'll do the last part on firewalls and intrusion prevention systems. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we're all complete. So let's continue with the last chapter that we actually do from the book on firewalls and intrusion prevention systems. First, let's have a closer look at why actually we need firewalls. Nowadays, everything goes over the internet. So internet connectivity is very, very essential for companies, for organizations, but also for individuals, of course. But that creates a new threat. That means that we need our local area network is connected to the big internet, and that we need some kind of protection between the internet and our local area network. So we need a kind of protection between local area network and the internet on the border between the two, on the perimeter. So that's why we need firewalls. Let's see what a firewall actually is. We must make sure that all the traffic between the inside and the outside of the firewall, between the network, between the internet and the local area network, passes through the firewall. It should not be possible to bypass the firewall. So this should not happen. You can see that. There's actually a access control there in the middle of the road, but apparently cars are found a way around it. So if we have a firewall that actually works like this protection, it doesn't really work. Yeah, all the traffic should go through the firewall such that it can be inspected. The firewall should then be such that only authorized traffic is allowed through to go into the network or out into the internet. And we must make sure, obviously, the firewall is our main protection, that the firewall can't be hacked. So that should be immune to penetration. So we should use a hardened system as we discussed last week. How can we do filtering of traffic on a firewall? Well, one way is looking at IP addresses and protocol values. Yeah, where is the traffic coming from? Where is it going? So source and destination IP address. We can do this packet by packet. We can also have something which is called stateful inspection firewalls. We'll get to that in a minute. And we can use this to limit the access to also specific services. Yeah, if a service is not allowed in or out, then the firewall will block that. We can look at the application protocol. It's the so-called application level gateway. We'll discuss that in more detail also in a minute. And then one thing that we also have to look at is user identity. Maybe some kind of authentication will be implemented on the firewall. Network activity, we can also look at that. Or the firewall can also look at that. We can look at the rate of requests. So, for example, to detect a denial of service attack where a lot of packets are sent in a short time, again, that could be blocked by the firewall. A firewall defines a single choke point, so all the traffic should go through that firewall, as I said before. That will be the point where we inspect all the traffic for security events. Is a particular packet allowed to get in or not? We talked last week, I think it was, about IPsec and about tunnel mode in IPsec. That can actually be a functionality of the firewall. Well, there's some limitations also. If there is a way to bypass the firewall, then actually the firewall doesn't really help me anything. Yeah, it can't protect against an attack that bypasses it. That is nowadays relatively easy. Yeah, this device is connected to the. Is not under control of the school here, yeah. But it has internet connectivity. It is connected to the network here, without going through the firewall. So with this bring your own device, you get these kinds of issues nowadays. Wireless LAN, same way, we can get access via the wireless LAN to the network without going through the firewall. If I look at the firewall, there are two types of filtering. We have a positive filter and a negative filter. A positive filter will stop all the traffic except the traffic that meets specific descriptions, so meets particular specifications. Yeah, everything is blocked except that traffic that is allowed. The other one is negative filter, it's the other way around. Everything is allowed except if I know that a packet is negative, yeah, that it has some meets some specification that shows that it is an intrusion, then I block it. Yeah, two completely different types. Firewall is, as I said before, in between the external network, the internet, and my own internal network. So this is called here. It's called firewall. Before I named it an external firewall. This is the one between my own network and the internet. And there are different types of firewalls. There are four different types that we will discuss. There is packet filtering. We'll discuss that in a bit more detail. Then there is stateful inspection, which is a slight deviation from packet filtering. And then there is application and circuit level proxy firewalls. Let's go to the packet filtering firewall first. We have a number of rules, and those rules will say something about... we have a number of rules, and the rules will say something about allowance of particular IP traffic to go in or out. Often done on matching the IP address source or destination IP address or the TCP header, information in the TCP header. I will give an example on the next slide so it will become more clear also. Again, there are two default policies, as I said before, with the negative and the positive. Here it's called the discard. Yeah, it's everything is prohibited unless explicitly permitted, and which is obviously more conservative. It's a lot of control there, but it probably also needs more administration there. And the other one is forward. Everything is everything is allowed except when it is explicitly prohibited, which is easier to manage. So here we see a set of rules, a set of filtering rules for email, SMTP traffic, which is on port 25. Protocol is TCP. And we see that if the, let's go at rule one, if the direction is in, so from the internet into my network, from an external source address to an internal source address, the protocol is TCP and the port number is 25. That will indicate that SMTP traffic inbound into the organization. And apparently that is allowed. Action is permitted. Same if I send an email out. So the source address is internal and the destination address is external. And I respond to SMTP. Then my port number will be over 1023. And so that can be then sent out. So that is a response to actually some incoming SMTP traffic. Yeah, and the same, if I start the communication, if I start the SMTP communication, I use port 25. Yeah, the destination port, sorry, I have to think a bit. The destination port is 25, and my own port will be some random number over 1023. Yeah, so the outgoing traffic is to destination port 25, and the incoming traffic in rule 4 will be to a port number over 1023, responding to the port number that I just used. Yeah, all of that is permitted. SMTP traffic, either initiated from the inside or the outside, and then the response to that. Everything else in this simple firewall is not permitted. Yeah. So that is, however, a problem. If I look at rule 4 simply says that external traffic to any destination port number above 1023 is allowed. Rule 4 was actually as a reply to be able to get a reply based on something sent out in according to rule 3. Yeah, but I can misuse it. So I should be more restrictive. Yeah. One way that I can do is by also requiring not just something about the destination port, but also about something of the source port. So yes, I allow something from external source address to an internal source address where the destination port is over 1023, as long as the source port is 25. And 25 normally stands for the SMTP protocol. But yeah, that is just a... that's not always needed to follow those guidelines. So actually, port number 25 could mean something else for the one sending the information. And so they could still sneak in some traffic that is unwanted. And we can again solve that in some way by requiring that the acknowledged flag is set. And so you see that making these kinds of rules look simple. We try to make them based on what we think is normal traffic, but we have to consider every time that the viewpoint from the attacker also. How can an attacker misuse a particular rule in a firewall filter? Yeah. So what's the advantage of a packet filtering firewall? Well, it's simple. You saw a number of rules. They were not really secure, but you could extend them to make them more secure. But it's simple. It is transparent to the users. Users doesn't have to care about anything, and it's relatively fast to check these filters. And you can also make it such that that all of the other traffic is denied at the end. So you have one last line in your filter that denies all traffic that doesn't follow any of the rules. Unfortunately, there are a number of weaknesses also. For example, improper configuration can lead to breaches. As I saw, as we just discussed with this particular rule 4, which from a logical point made good sense. I can send out something in the SMTP protocol and I need to get a response back, but the way it was implemented was not sufficient. There are a number of ways to attack, in fact, a packet filtering firewall. One of them could be IP address spoofing. So what would happen if the incoming packet all of a sudden would have an internal IP address? Yeah, then all of a sudden a different rule would be applied, not the rule for external IP addresses, but some for internal IP addresses, which could then be used to get into the to get access to the network. Now, one simple way of just preventing that is just checking if we have in or outgoing network traffic, and if it's incoming and it is from an internal IP address, then just discard it right away. No further checking. Source routing attacks. Apparently, it's possible to determine how a packet is routed around the internet. And that can be used to just avoid being detected, to bypass the security measures. Yeah, to take such a route that the attacker is sure that it will arrive at the correct location. One way is, again, if that option is used in a packet, just discard that packet. That's a way to protect against that. Tiny fragment attack. In a tiny fragment attack, what is done is to make the fragment, to fragment the packet, and to make the fragment so small that part of the header is not in the first fragment, but in another fragment. Because often the first fragment in a communication is just inspected. Yeah, and if I make sure that all the relevant information that should be checked is not in there, only the one that I know that can be checked without any problem, but all the other one is just removed or is in the second fragment or third fragment or whatever. Yeah, then after if the packet filter firewall will only check the first fragment, yeah, then it will just not have enough information to build the decision upon, and then that might lead to the packet being allowed into the network. And again, a very simple countermeasure is just making sure that the first fragment contains all the relevant information. If information is missing, discard the packet again. Yeah, so then this will not work anymore. An extension of packet filtering is stateful inspection. Yeah, it still uses packet filtering, but it keeps a track of the connections that are alive. Let's look at this picture. In principle, if I would take away the state info, I would have a simple packet filter firewall. But in this case, the stateful inspection firewall will keep track of all the connections that are built up. And if there is information from a new connection, it will get rigorous checking, of course. If it's a setup connection already, it could check things like, is the sequence number correct, and more. So it knows some more. It knows what connections are set up already. For example, again, the packet filter where the fourth rule was not correct, it could check there again if that was a communication back into the system from an existing connection or not. Yeah, so you get a large table of, this is just a small table, but you get a large table of connections both ways, of course. So from the internal to the external and the other way around. Then the two last types of firewalls. One was the application level proxy, the other was circuit level proxy. Application level proxy or gateway, whatever you want, looks at the traffic at the application level, as the name says. In principle, from the outside, you think that you see the applications. But in principle, you just see a proxy of the application that will make a connection to the real application once the user is authenticated. And once the firewall knows that there is a that it's a correct user, it will then forward the connection. So these kinds of firewalls tend to be more secure than packet filter, but obviously there is a huge overhead, additional overhead on the processing. Circuit level filter, circuit level proxy or circuit level gateway, more or less similar to the proxy level, except we don't look at the application level, we look at the transport level now. Okay, then something about different. Something about firewall basing. Bastion host is a system identified as a critical strong point in a network security. Yeah, so it serves as a platform for application level or circuit level gate, as a circuit level proxy or gateway. And it has some common characteristics. So it has to be a secure system. It has to be a hardened operating system, again, that we discussed last week. It runs a secure operating system with only essential services. We discussed all of that last week, so I'm not going into detail. Limited disk use. Read only is needed. Yeah, so write access is not given, for example. Yeah, make sure that indeed the system that we use here is secure and can't be attacked. Then there is host-based firewalls. They are used to protect a specific host, an individual host. This is nowadays more available than it used to be. Single operating systems already provide firewall capacity. If not, then obvious. Then sometimes add-ons can be installed for that. Commonly located at a server, because a server needs more protection than an end user. What are the advantages of having actually the firewall at the server? Is that I can protect according to the very specific requirements that I have, the very specific environment of that server. So I can tailor everything to the particular situation. And then the last is a personal firewall, used on a computer workstation that an end user uses, both at home or for a corporate user. If we look at a home situation, everybody has these wireless routers there. Often they are equipped with a firewall functionality also nowadays. Primary rule is to deny unauthorized remote access. That's clear, I guess. Let's say something about where we put the firewall. We talked about external firewall before, which is actually the boundary between the internet and my own network, my own local area network. Here we have a picture where there are two firewalls. We have an external firewall and an internal firewall. In between them is what we call the demilitarized zone. A demilitarized zone is often a zone in real military talk. It's a zone where there should not be any military activity or any military equipment. Why is there a demilitarized zone? That is because there needs to be access to particular servers, like a web server, email server, DNS server, from the outside. Yeah, so there is a number of servers that needs to be accessed from the internet, and not just from the internal network. Yeah, there needs to be some protection for that also. So that's why there is an external firewall, and the demilitarized zone is behind the external firewall. But we want to give people access to those, but we want to protect our network also. So that's why there is an internal firewall. That again, it's more strict in its checking, yeah, so it's more stringent. Provides protection for the demilitarized zone actually in both ways. If an attacker could have compromised one of the servers in the demilitarized zone, it can then still protect the communication into the internal network. Yeah, but it can also protect the demilitarized zone against an attack from the internal network, so an internal intruder. Now it's just one, in this picture it's just one internal firewall, but again I could have more firewalls at different levels, same as we had for the intrusion detection system. We can have it at different places. One way to set up secure connections is also using virtual private networks. In a virtual private network, it's virtual, so what I'll do is I'll use an insecure infrastructure. So I have a network that exists where there is no security, and what I'll make sure, and I have access to a number of separated local area networks that I can secure myself, and which have their own external firewalls. And now if I need to communicate between one of these areas and another, I have to go over an insecure network. And so what I'll do is I'll make sure that the communication between firewalls is secured, it's encrypted. And so all the communication between firewalls is secure, and so it looks like I am on one network. So the end users in this network don't have to think about communicating in a secure way to the users over here, extra security that is, because the connection between the two firewalls will be encrypted anyway. Compare it to the tunnel mode that we, or the, it's the tunnel mode that we discussed last week also. Yeah, so the firewall will then take care of, on the one hand, compressing and encrypting the information, on the other hand, decrypting and decompressing, expanding the information. Authentication can also be provided because that's a normal part of IPsec. Distributed firewall, that's what I mentioned on the first slide. We can have firewalls also on the servers or firewalls on the workstations, just as an extra protection. We can have, in principle, I could also split up this this internal network into multiple subnets and then have each subnet again with a specific internal firewall again. Yeah, so I can build layered protection here. There are a number of topologies that we can have for the firewalls. Host resident firewall and which is on a just on a host and screening route. I will not go into those a lot. This is maybe the first interesting one, single bastion inline, which means that I have a firewall, single firewall, so the external firewall, which has an incoming internet interface, yeah, for the outside world, for the internet, and one going into the internal network. Yeah, and what is done there is that all the traffic is passing through the firewall, and all the traffic is controlled by the one firewall. If I have a single bastion T, then I actually have two ports on the inside, two interfaces on the inside of the firewall. So I have one connection to the outside, but to the inside, I have two connections, one going into the demilitarized zone, and one into the rest of the network. So I can have different filtering rules for the traffic that is going to the demilitarized zone, and more stringent requirements, more stringent filtering for the traffic that is passing to the internal internet. Yeah, which I can't have in a single bastion inline. If I have two firewalls, the internal and the external firewall, I can again have that as inline or as double bastion T. Yeah. And then the last topology is the distributed that I showed a slide ago. And so the way that I set up my firewalls in my network can follow any of these topologies, depending on my requirements, of course. Finally, I want to say something very briefly about intrusion prevention systems. And why is it very briefly? Because I just talked about intrusion detection systems, and more or less everything that I'm going to say now is a repetition of what I said before. Yeah, the only difference between an intrusion The difference between an intrusion detection system and an intrusion prevention system is that the detection system just detects that an attack is that there might be something going on, and he just presents that information to the administrator. An intrusion prevention system might in fact take action on this. So you can see an intrusion detection system as a combination of an intrusion prevention system as a combination of an intrusion detection system plus firewall functionality. All the rest that I can say stays the same. You have host-based intrusion prevention systems, signature-based or anomaly-based. The behavior that it can look at, it's the same as for an intrusion detection system. Can tailor to the specific platform. All of this stays the same. There's nothing new. Yeah, use a sandbox approach. That's maybe new. an intrusion prevention system. I guess an intrusion detection system can do this too. What it can do is use a sandbox approach. So whenever there is code, let's say there is a Java code, a Java applet, that is that wants to execute on my system. What it does is it creates a sandbox and executes the code first in the sandbox. And then if some strange behavior is detected there, it just kills the code. It doesn't execute it on the real system. If the code executes in a normal manner, so if no anomaly behavior is detected, it then will execute it in the real system. So that might be something new. Although an intrusion detection system could, in principle, use a similar approach, except that simultaneously it will execute in the sandbox and it will execute in the real system, and then based on the sandbox result, or based on the system result, doesn't really matter. It will raise an alarm if needed. See here. Yeah, the it's noted that the attackers now pay much more attention to the host, the end user systems. And so one of the things that the industry, the protection industry, the security industry is doing now is also focusing more on the endpoint security. And then before we had all kinds of different products. We had antivirus, anti-spyware, anti-spam, etc., which might software that might be fighting each other at some point in time. Now they are focusing more on a single integrated system that can protect against all of these vulnerable or these potential attacks. Network-based intrusion prevention system, again, very similar to network-based intrusion detection system. There is no surprise here. Okay, good. That was actually the last I wanted to say, because the next is again an example that you can go over in the book yourself. So I will not discuss that here. Any questions on firewalls? Okay, good. I got a question now during the break, and I got it also a couple of times over email about the third assignment. I will start grading that now. I was a bit behind with my work, so I will make sure that hopefully very soon all is graded. I would guess early next week that I will be finished with that. And so then those grades and the comments will also be published. Okay, then thank you, and then I'll see you next week. Yeah.